I am the architect. I created the Matrix.
Shall we play a game?
Hello and good Tuesday morning to all of you, including my listener or listeners. Oh my gosh, I'm in Palm Desert, California, and I clearly am living my dream. It was 80 degrees and sunny when I got up this morning. I took my chair, set it out on the area by the pond and watched the golf course in the mountains, and it was spectacular. Sometimes I think you have to reach out and do something that is not normal for you or outside your normal scope to create an event in your life. And I did that some years ago, and I'm going to tell you quickly about it. I was in the Midwest. I was in Kansas, by the way. I was with my brother, who was a pilot. He took me out to visit a plane that he had been flying with a buddy of his. It was a Cessna 172. These are single engine, single propeller planes. They seat four people. And I looked at it, and it turned out it was for sale. So usually I think through things logically, but I said, let's just buy it. So I bought it on the spot. I did not have a pilot's license. I'd never been in a small plane before. My brother had. My brother liked the plane. He said it was a good buy, so I bought it. But I bought it on one condition, that my brother, who is a pilot, would fly it with me out to California. That's right, from Kansas City, Kansas, out to Palo Alto, California. He agreed. So here we go. So a few days later, we gas it up. We put a few clothes together. We throw them in the back of the plane, and we're off. And I can tell you, it was an incredible experience, and I can really understand why the commercial pilots who fly the 747s and 727s don't like the small planes in the air. I'll tell you my first part of the story. So we landed in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And while we were there, we go to what's called a fixed base operator, an FBO. That's an area of the airport that services small planes. So we stopped there and we started talking to another pilot that was there. He was also flying a Cessna 172. He had his wife and two children with him. And we struck up a conversation. He told us where we were going, where he was going. We didn't think much of it. So anyway, we both take off. We get up in the air. We actually see him off to our right. I don't know, maybe a mile away. So we somehow we were able to get him on our radio and start talking to him. And we said, where are you going? And he said he was going to, I don't know, Albuquerque or something. And he said, that was his next stop. So I was starting to really get into navigation. I knew the burn rate of our gasoline. I knew about Vortex, which I'll pick you up on later. I'll talk to you about Vortex. Anyway, so I looked over my brother and I said, you know, he doesn't have enough fuel to get to Albuquerque because he has the same plane we did. Bud says, oh, no, he must have enough. And I said, no, I'm looking at the numbers here. He doesn't. So Bud says, well, get him on the phone. Bud, by the way, is my brother. I got the pilot on the phone of the other plane. And I said, hey, look, I'm just doing some calculations. You have the same burn rate we do, same Cessna 172. And I don't think you have enough fuel to get to where you're going. He says, I'll check it. Comes back a few minutes later and says, hey, you're right. I'm going to have to stop and get some more gas. Small plane pilots. Now, I mentioned Vortex. Now, one of the reasons that flying is pretty easy in this country is throughout the country, we have a thing called a Vortex. You may have seen them, but didn't know what they were. But they're an object that's about 30 feet diameter. They are round, and then at the center, they've got like a pole or a pylon that goes up about 20 feet in the air. They're basically a broadcasting station. So what does it mean for me? Okay, we're flying a 172. I've got two, what they call navcoms. So not knowing exactly where we were, I take one navcom, I look at a map, I get the frequency of one Vortex, and I dial into that. And that gives me, let's say, a line of sight or line of electronic sight to that Vortex. I dial into another Vortac, the other NavCom. Now I've got two lines that intersect, and I know where I am. I became quite a good navigator on the flight out there to California. A second part of the story, right? So we are on the way to Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport. We pass over something called the Roosevelt Dam. While we're in the air, about 10,000 feet, it started raining. Now, rain on a Cessna 172 sounds like their bullets are bouncing off your wings. It is noisy. It for some reason, it wasn't scary, but it's noisy. You still have some visibility, but the noise, the rain bouncing off the wing just drives you nuts. So for maybe 20 minutes, we're in this rainstorm. We call Sky Harbor Airport, and they say, no problem. When you get over the Roosevelt Dam area, the rain goes away, you'll be okay. So sure enough, we stuck with it. Wasn't much, bumpiness, no turbulence in the air, but noise, very scary noise. So we get over the dam, and sure enough, it goes away. We see an airport. We call Sky Harbor. We say, we have the airport in sight. We'd like to have permission to land. They say, no problem, come in and land. So bingo, we start down. And just as we're landing at this airport, a military jet takes off beneath us, and it dawns on us, we must be on the wrong airport. So he went back up in the air, back up 10,000 feet, called Sky Harbor again, and we said where we were, and they said, well, you're 8 miles away from Sky Harbor. And we said, we thought you had us in sight. And they said, no, we thought you saw us. You see the humor in this? Or you see the danger in it? Anyway, to make a long story short, so we go ahead. Now we're heading off to Sky Harbor Airport. We get to Sky Harbor Airport. They give us a runway to land. Now remember, we're new in the area. We did never land at Sky Harbor Airport before. My brother, this was his first cross-country trip on a Cessna 172. And of course, what did I know? Nothing. So I'm not kidding you. We're 200 or 300 feet from touchdown. And the airport tower says, up. Wrong runway, switch to another runway. Thank God my brother was a good airport, did a big left-hand turn, and just slid into this other runway, and we landed no problem. Now, a little bit scary. The whole thing was a pretty scary process, but it gave me kind of like reason to understand why commercial pilots don't like small pilots in the air. And frankly, people in the towers don't take care of you that well. Well, guess what? We picked up Helen. Helen got on the back seat. We take off from Phoenix Airport. Now we're headed to Palo Alto, California. We go through the Banning Pass. Now, if you've ever been to Palm Springs, there's an area called the Banning Pass. There's mountains on both sides. It's a high traffic area. So we called into LA Tower, and we said, and we're probably 125 miles from Los Angeles, but we told them we were in the Banning Pass, and they, yeah, we can see you on the radar, but they don't know really how high we are, because we don't have the electronics to do that. But they did come back and they said, Learjet, 6 miles on your 12 o'clock, which means it's right in front of us. Now, I don't know if they knew how high the Learjet was or not, but they came back like 10 seconds later and said, Learjet, 4 miles. And then they said, Learjet, 2 miles. Then they said, Learjet, clear. By that time, our nose were broken from looking out the window for a jet, because obviously, a jet would fly through us like food through a goose. Anyway, so we recognize that, you don't see all the airplanes in the air. So we fly a little bit further. Now we're probably up toward Santa Cruz. We're actually heading toward a Vortac, which is right west of the airport, west of San Francisco Airport. Because you fly to a Vortac, and then you fly to another Vortac, or fly around one. Anyway, so we call in for the weather. It's just foggy, visibility poor. I looked over to my brother and I said, we can see the ocean from where we are. I can see Santa Cruz. I said, it's totally clear. There's no fog and visibility is perfect. We called the weather guy again. Fog, visibility, blah, blah, blah. So then we called San Francisco Airport, now the tower. And we said, hey, we're getting conflicting information. They said, yes, sure. That radio recording that you were hearing was recorded early this morning when they had fog. There's no fog now. I thought, wow, that's great. So if we hadn't called San Francisco Airport, we'd probably be turning around trying to land, thinking there was no visibility. And turns out visibility was perfect. Okay, that's not finished, but it's almost finished. So we asked San Francisco Tower, we were trying to land at Palo Alto Airport, can you help us? They said, sure, no problem. About 50 minutes later, they called back and they said, no, we can't help you. We're too busy. Try the Oakland Tower. The Oakland Tower is on the other side of the bay. We called the Oakland Tower and they said, yeah, we can help you for a few minutes. So the long and the short of it is they finally helped us kind of navigate through the area, a lot navigate through the area. There's a lot of rules of flying an airplane in the Bay Area, what altitude you can fly at and things like that. Anyway, we landed at Palo Alto Airport, small airport, mostly small planes. I went in and I said, hey, I got it. Just bought this airplane, flew it out here. I need a place to park it. They said, no problem. They gave me a place. I signed up and that was it. I learned later that the waiting time for a parking spot at the Palo Alto Airport for a small plane is 2 years. So I must have arrived right when somebody else gave their spot up and I was there at the right time and I got the spot. Now, it's an interesting story. We did a lot more flying. One last point is that, yes, I did take pilot's lessons. I did flunk. My teacher finally came to me and said, hey, look, you're not ever going to be a pilot. Okay, I'm not ever going to be a pilot. And one of the tests was, by the way, you had to fly over the Stanford campus, which I did many times. They have a campanile, and you have to circle the campanile and not lose altitude. I couldn't do it. Like every time I made a left turn, bingo, I'm losing altitude. So finally she came to me, my instructor, and said, you can't be a pilot. Okay, jump forward. Years later, the Kauffman Foundation paid $10,000 to send me to a high-level leadership school in San Diego, California. The school where the generals go and the top leaders go of the country. So here I am at this top leadership school. It lasts a week. You go through all kinds of tests and exams. You do teamwork analysis. You're analyzed by your team members. A group of observers look through a window when you're doing a team project and they evaluate you. So you get evaluated independently by observers. You get evaluated independently by your team members. The evaluations go on and on and on, and the feedback is really horrific for a week, and it's kind of hard, but it's a learning experience. But here's the point. Here's the point. So finally, I'm with the psychologist on the last day. You spend 2 hours with the psychologist. He explains all the reports that you've gone through to. He looks at me and says, well, Mr. Sherwood, I've looked at all your reports. All I can tell you is that you have very high IQ, very articulate. But based on this, you can't be a brain surgeon or a pilot. That's exactly what he said. You can't be a pilot. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, one of the tests we give you is the same test they give pilots. And you flunked it. You have to answer 10 questions. You only answered one right. And I said, well, kind of explain it to me in a little more detail. He said, well, pilots, good pilots, have the ability to look out their window and see the ground and see, you know, trees and railroad, you know, and roads and things, and look back at the map and know exactly where they are. So I think they call it spatial configuration mapping. And I noticed my brother could do that. If we didn't know where we were, he'd put a map in front of me, look outside, see the ground. He looked back and he'd point and he said, that's where we are right there. And I said, well, how in the world can you do that so fast? Well, they just do it. Pilots do it. So I wasn't surprised that I couldn't be a pilot because I can't do it. I like to study a map, but I can't look out a window and then look back at a map and see exactly where I am. That's the end of the story. Now, there is a message there. It's kind of a story in and of itself. Maybe there are some interesting points. Sure, it was fun buying that Cessna 172. We used to fly up and get what we'd call $100 hamburgers up around Fairfield, California. $100 because hamburger was 10 bucks and gas was 90. But it was something that was a good part of my life. I took the grounds, the ground class, which is studying navigation, things like that. I had no problem with that. The navigation came as easy to me as algebra, but the actual piloting was something different. So there's some messages there, maybe it was impetuous of me to buy the airplane, but it was fun. It was a great story. And like I say, I'm living the dream, because how many people can sit here in Palm Desert, California and say, I used to own a Cessna 172. I used to fly it around California with the help of a pilot. And that was a great part of my life. And I learned a lot about being careful with not only with an airplane, but anything else you're doing, because just because the other guy says, hey, I've got enough gas to get there, doesn't mean he really does know what he's talking about. So that's a story for today. I really hope that you look at that and think about it and think, well, there's some message there that Sherwood is trying to give us. It's not really hidden. You can be impetuous and do things, but if you don't do anything, nothing ever happens. So the issue is, what are you doing today or tomorrow or this week that's creating your story? Or is your story just happening to you? Or are you creating your story? I created my story. I bought that Cessna 172 and I eventually sold it. That's all for today. It's been great talking to you. I hope you learned something from this. I got a lot more stuff coming in the next few days. I've got a couple more interviews. I'm going to interview somebody who did the rim to rim to rim. They run down one side of the Grand Canyon. They run across the valley floor. They run up the other side. They run back down on the other, and then they come back. They start at 3:30 in the morning. They try to do it in 14 hours. I think it's 47 miles. It's called rim to rim to rim. You can Google it. And I'm going to interview that person. Should be some fun. All right. Have a good day, and we'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.